We got it going. All right. This is the 7th of November, 2020. My name is Charles Stewart, and we are here to promote law and order in the United States of America and all around the world, including our Canadian friends. And and many of us are real serious about looking at the spiritual side of this entire spiritual conflict that we find ourselves in. And thereunder, we like to take a moment to go through the ritual of a prayerful supplication to the positive side of the spirit realm to bless us in our efforts of promoting righteous truth and justice on this earth. And hereunder, I would like to go ahead and take just a moment or two to set the tone humbly for all of us before the superior spiritual realms and the champions of truth and justice that transcend this physical plane. And so, without further ado, champion of truth and justice in the universe, under the Abrahamic tradition, Yahweh Jehovah, we humbly approach you in the name of your precious Son, Jesus Yeshua. Please send your angels and your Holy Spirit to guide and direct us. Help us to be well-focused and serious about carrying on the righteous side of this spiritual battle so that we may promote truth and justice on this earth in a courageous manner, but also help us to be humble before the cause of truth so that we are not in error, that we are humble enough to self-correct when our brothers and sisters point out to us how we may be making a mistake in our ways of looking at the universe in this spiritual battle here. So, similarly as your precious Son Jesus Yeshua did 2,000 years ago, please help us to follow his example. And in his precious name, we humbly pray these things. Amen. Okay, thank you all. I see Michael's with us. Excellent, Michael. Would anybody care to say hi? Just new people that have come in real quick? Anybody? Here, none. Agenda item two. I've actually got my own PDF version of it up this time so I can follow a little bit more closely. The strategic benefits of organizing all national and state communities along the model of 12 basic superstates. This gets into the spiritual foundation for the common law process that we're trying to invoke. There's been lots that has been lost because of the forces of evil. After the Jewish Revolution in AD 66, the Roman Empire burnt millions of books and texts. And similarly, after the Norman conquest of England by the Roman model of government, Roman Empire slave traders, they similarly burnt texts and obliterated the history. And so, the history is, we do have the legend of King Arthur, which in his round table, there was, if you study it, that according to the legend, there were 12 seats at that round table of King Arthur. And that's the legend of how common law tradition works. That's all we've got is a legend. But similarly, Jesus had 12 apostles, and there were 12 tribes of Israel in ancient Israel, and there were 12 princes of Israel that were the leaders of those 12 tribes. And based thereon, through logical deduction, is what I've come to, is that the divinely inspired model of government requires a governing body of 12. This facilitates organic accountability to the smaller communities. It facilitates, before even the organic accountability, is the consensus building process, so that with smaller governing bodies of 12s or 10s, you can realistically hope to build consensus. If you've got 435 people in your governing body, your lawmaking body, you can't build consensus. It's a humongous workload to do it amongst all of those people. But if you arrange all the people in hierarchies where only the people that are elected to the higher levels are the ones with voting capabilities, then those people that have percolated up because of their skills in being responsibly self-governing people, they become the elite, the nobility, by election, by organic accountability. And from those, when you build consensus, then it's reasonably presumable that everybody underneath them that has elected them to their positions will consent to whatever policies are unanimously adopted from the inner circle of 12. And this plugs into the Seventh Amendment, U.S. Constitution, priority, level of higher law. The jury trial verdicts are a system of higher law. Jury trials only happen under the tradition and rules of the common law as articulated in that Seventh Amendment. And so through this multiple factors overlaying, here under it's promoting efficiency.
Good afternoon. Today is July 9th, 2000.
Some background noise there. Please mute. We're promoting efficiency in our model of government. Once we get enough people that are in the 12 positions of leadership for our nation, and I suggest our Canadian friends try to follow the same model, once we get people in positions of leadership, we get enough people involved in our process from the grassroots bottom up, then we will be in an unadulterated and unhindered mode of procedure where we can confront the de factos, the corrupted form of Roman Empire model of government that is presently oppressing us all. We will be in a position of power under the authority of the higher law referenced in the Seventh Amendment. The Seventh Amendment doesn't clearly declare itself higher law, but by implication, there are multiple levels of lower level law, and the wording of the Seventh Amendment clearly implies that because no fact tried by a jury shall be reexamined other than according to the rules of the common law, once we produce our jury verdict, then nobody else can challenge our jury verdict unless they produce a similar jury verdict, and they also follow the rules of the common law better than us, which they will probably never do. So this is the logic and reasoning behind the importance of the organizing under the 12 superstates model. And we're attempting to set the example of how to run jury trials according to due process of law, because a judicial decision is higher than a legislative decision. I should probably put a wrap on that. Is there questions or comments? I'm thinking of going on to the next item, unless there's questions or comments about how this general organizing process works and why we're so firmly embracing it as an alternative to everything else on the table. Any comments or questions on that before we move on to another agenda item? I yield.
Charles, anybody? I do have one quick question, Charles, and forgive me because this has probably been something that I missed in the last couple of meetings. You said something about 12 superstates. Is your intention to have 12? I'm just trying to see it on the screen as I'm talking. To have 12 new republics form a union?
I wouldn't word it precisely that way, but that's pretty close. Can you see the map that Lewis has brought up on the screen there?
Yeah, I'm on my cell phone, so it's a little hard, but I can see, I can get the general consensus of what's going on
okay,
here.
Each of these geographical areas, in how I'm visualizing this, there will be one delegate, at least temporarily, filling the vacant office for each of these jurisdictions. And three of the super states here are just single states, New York, Texas, and California, because they've got real big populations. But all of the other nine super states, are communities of states merged together so that the population counts are approximately equal. We're concerned with what's called proportional representation here.
Absolutely.
So that each of the communities gets one vote and is carrying approximately equal of the burdens for the whole country.
Mm-hmm.
And it's designed to promote what really should be thought of as organic government. There's different definitions of the words organic law and stuff. They call the written constitution documents organic law frequently, and municipal charters for local cities and counties and stuff. They call that organic law, but it's statutory, licensed franchise. It's not really organic, you know. That's the brief explanation, Shane. Did I explain adequately there?
Absolutely. I was wondering exactly the direction, because I was trying to envision, would you be keeping the same 50 states as is and going forward that way? And I didn't see that as too feasible. I've always thought of some way to break down the United States into larger regions that were more similar and could work together in this communal way. So I was very interested to see that map.
All right. Thank you. I'm glad you can see some merit in what we're trying to promote here.
Absolutely.
All right. Is there any comments or questions from anybody else here? Hearing none. Let's cruise on down to get my glasses. Agenda item 3, organizing locally townships, precincts, and counties. Yes. And perhaps Lewis can you pull up a couple of those documents, maybe, Lewis? We've constructed documents that show how to organize at the grassroots level. See, we can organize at the same time both nationally and locally. And the township is the smallest unit. It's the 10-household unit. That's the grassroots level where we're starting to organize. And we've constructed documents here that explain how to do this locally. And yes, notice of the formation of responsibly self-governing communities. Maybe we can hold on that one just for a moment there, Lewis. This document really gets into the nuts and bolts of how and why we have lawful authority to form our own townships and precincts as responsibly self-governing communities locally. And as the header there indicates, this document is not only designed to be a foundation for our people that are trying to form the self-governing communities, but it's also designed to be presented to the presently existing de facto government that's already in place, your local city council members and county attorney, city council and city attorneys, and county council and county attorneys, and county sheriff, and chief of police. See, when we present documents like these to the powers that be, the governing authorities of our local jurisdiction, they've had constructive notice. It's being presented to them. And near the end of the document, we're asking for them to respond in a timely manner. Lewis, can you maybe scroll on down to that end signature line there, too, there's a final phraseology there that, yes, let me pull it down on my copy so I can see it. Constructive criticism of all statements made herein are invited. All parties have any objections to our declarations made herein, please declare your lawful basis in such or such in a prompt and timely manner, or else stand presumed to have agreed by default as to the truth of these declarations. Okay? And I believe I'm saying the same thing in other areas of the document, along with the constructive notice of treason document. And see, this is standard commercial and administrative process that they usually function under. And so they're familiar with the concept of defaulting in response to issues that have been presented before them. And they usually...
Charles, if I may, what page were you reading from? What page?
Page, the last page on the document, page 15 of 15.
15? Okay.
Yeah, just right above the signature line there, the last little page.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, you've got it there. Yeah, that's it, Lewis. And so this is basically a cakewalk. All we need is people with the courage to begin confronting their governmental authorities, their Roman Empire model of governmental authorities, not only locally, but all on up the chain of command, your local county commissioners, your state representative and your state senators, and then your federal representatives and your federal senators, and your state governor and your state attorney general. And we've got the moral high ground and the legal high ground. This is a situation wherein they're creatures of darkness, and they probably will not engage with us in discussing the merits of these bold propositions. But they're also moving forward in an aggressive manner with their coronavirus medical emergency declarations and everything like this. They're advancing a military form of tyranny over us. And so this is putting a line in the sand. This is drawing a line in the sand, so to speak, that we're not going to take it anymore. We've got the right and the duty to resist their agenda of evil. We've got the right to self-govern in our own communities, and our own communities, through due process of law, can declare that the de facto municipal form of government is engaged in massive fraud on a number of issues that are important, not only the medical emergency issues. And so this lays the foundation for us to enter into a serious eyeball-to-eyeball debate about which way the guns are going to be pointed and who's going to get them pointed at them. And that's where it needs to go. I think most of you are probably alert enough to recognize that we're in precarious times, and the agenda of militarism and tyranny and despotism is ratcheting up in our times here, and we need a game plan for how to counter it. And in my humble opinion, this is the most advanced game plan available. It's based upon biblical Torah law. It's harmonious with our constitutional common law tradition, and And further, it works. When you try to talk to people about this in positions of power, they routinely run and hide because they don't like talking about it. It causes them pain. But anyway, yes, these are the self-governing communities that we're talking about that are referenced in our agenda item 3. And I encourage everyone to take time to look at those documents. The citations document in support of the main document there has many citations that Zach, what our authority is in law to be doing things like this. I'll pause for a moment there. Comments and questions from anyone. Anyone have any comments or questions on any of the issues discussed so far?
And I'd also like to remind everyone to either use star 6 or mute themselves on their phone, or if they're dialing in over the computer, the microphone. We're getting some background noise. Last 4 digits of your phone are 4538. So please, if you could, mute yourself. Thank you. I yield.
Thank you, Lewis. Let's go on to item 4A here, which is our process for affirming who is a qualified elector. As through the web links right under 4A there, we're also looking at the process for becoming a town constable and the process for becoming a justice of the peace judicial officer. The qualified elector status is, thank you, Lewis, for bringing those up. The process for becoming a qualified elector is really quite simple, and that's our grassroots level, traditional under common law, for organizing self-governing township communities. Township communities consist basically of 10 qualified electors and a 10-man army, 10 well-armed men. Women can have arms too, but at that point we've got more than 10 guns. It's 10 men is the traditional factor that I think is good to adhere to. And the grassroots qualified elector status, that's our basic building blocks. The 10 qualified electors decide from amongst their own members which of them they will elevate up to the position of their town constable, peace officer, leader. They choose from amongst themselves. This is real organic process, and they can call for votes of confidence and immediate recall on whoever has the office at any time that any of them feel like making such a call. This is one of the empowerments of being a qualified elector. You've got the right to call for a vote of confidence in your town constable. At any moment that you wake up and decide, I just feel like calling for a vote of confidence. It's that simple. You don't have to have a good reason. This is the kind of empowerment that comes with status as a qualified elector in the grassroots. I'd like to repeat a citation that's in the citation document. I don't want to look it up right now, but it defines a freeman as a member of a 10-household community, and it goes on to say that anyone who is not governed by a lord, a.k.a. a town constable, is unworthy of a freeman's right. And apparently in England there were people like that. They just wouldn't cooperate. They wouldn't go with the divinely inspired program. They didn't want to be part of any group, and so they were just out on their own. But at that point, they're not members of the community. And the benefits and advantages to being a member of the community, a responsible member of the self-governing community, are so strong that it's a blessing in no uncertain terms. If you can take the time to read it and you can come to comprehension of, you see, police officers can't lawfully touch you if you're a qualified elector. If you need to be arrested for having committed an actual crime, police officers or anybody else needs to come to your town constable. It's your town constable that you've helped elect to that position that will be the one in charge of arresting you if and when you ever do get arrested. See, these are protections from the insecurity and neurosis that we're currently suffering under with de facto Roman Empire model municipal police forces in place. So, anyway, and before you can become a town constable, you have to be a qualified elector. And thanks for the Justice of the Peace document there too, Lewis. Yeah, that before you can become a Justice of the Peace judicial officer at the 100 court at the precinct level, you have to be both a town constable and a qualified elector. So they build on top of each other. And there's not really much addition. You see, the Justice of the Peace judicial officer oath of office document, that spells out the duties of the judicial power. And once you've got the familiarity and the comfortableness with assuming that judicial power that's supposed to be in every precinct in the USA, there's about 300,000 of them if you look at precinct-like polling places too in the U.S. Census Bureau. That judicial power, that is, you control a 100-man army, and you control your own court process that follows due process of law, and that is the sovereignty. There is no more highly evolved form of government on this earth than that which a Justice of the Peace judicial officer should be properly exercising through his 100 court, court of justice, court of law. And so the point there, to reword it again, to emphasize, at the county level, the county judge is nothing more than a precinct-level Justice of the Peace judicial officer that's gone up another level. His duties are exactly the same, just to review. For the county judge, county sheriff, the county sheriff and county judge should be merged into one entity. There was no separation of executive and judicial powers in common law at all, and there was no separate executive sheriff and separate county judge. They were merged into one office. And similarly, on up to the state level, by logical implication, the judicial officer of the chief judicial officer of the state would also be the governor of the state. And similarly on up further through the super states and everything to the national governmental level, the president of the United States would also be the chief judge of the Supreme Court of Law for the United States of America. Similarly as what we're doing here, the jury foreman would have that kind of power. And we're just getting it started here. We're just stepping into the vacant offices under this common law, Torah law model in efforts to prime the pump. I certainly can very likely not be the one that's elected to that powerful position. And it might be somebody that's not even in attendance on this call. Maybe Jesus Christ will reincarnate and appear before us, and we'll take this kind of power. But the power needs to be recognized. This is the lawful process for establishing true rule of law, lawful government in the United States and in all common law tradition societies. Yes. So there's some bold statements there. I should yield for comments or questions. Anybody? Anybody? Okay. Let's go on. 4B. who is and who is not a qualified elector. this discussion frequently gets quite heated. There's a number of people in our general circles here that are deceivers. They posture as being honorable patriots, and they say good words, but they're not honorable people. They're deceivers, and they might very well be part of a COINTELPRO operation sent in from the de facto municipal form of government to subvert the ability of our common people to form our responsibly self-governing communities and thereby dismantle the evil empire. We don't need to know their precise motivations. All we need to know is that they're screwing things up and they're leading good people astray. And they're under, similarly as David Scheid and I have done through the web links there, we need to be encouraging people, each and every one of you, please be thinking about declaring publicly people that you affirm that are qualified electors, that are good and honorable people, that are trustworthy people, that you would consent to sit on a jury if somebody falsely accused you of committing some crime. These are the people that you would, quote, consent to be governed, unquote, by. See, you've got the right to choose your jury in advance of when you get charged with some kind of a crime. When the de factos are already ramping you up and trying to draw and quarter you in their corrupted courtroom process, it will be of immense advantage to you if you can just pull out a paper and say, hey, here's my list of people that I've consented to be governed by. These are the people that know my character. And they'll be. I trust them to responsibly decide whether or not I'm guilty of the crime I'm alleged to have committed here. If you've got your ducks lined up like that, you can resist the corrupted de facto limited jurisdiction court process that's coming at you. That's inferior court process. If you look at the wording of the Seventh Amendment, the trial by jury rules of the common law court process are superior. They're higher law. But the government, the de facto government, has the authority to use Roman Empire slave trading codes against you, where they make all kinds of presumptions, and it's summary military process. And you will be sucked into that unless you firmly entrench under the rules of the common law through process such as what we're advocating here, becoming a qualified elector, and declaring publicly who you agree is qualified electors, worthy of serving juries as jurors for you. And also similarly important is the other side of the coin, where there are people that are subversives. It's healthy. It's very, very healthy to be identifying the subversives and saying, I'm not going to be part of a community that allows that person in. At that point, if you and a person that you know is a subversive are part of the same township community, for example, then one or the other of you have to go, and the other eight members of the township community will have to start doing their homework real serious, and they're going to have to figure out whether or not it's you that's lying or the other person that you can probably prove your case against if you've been doing your homework right and been behaving in an honorable manner. So please consider making a list of people that you believe are honorable people that are worthy of sitting on jurors as your cases, and also on maybe a different list or extension of the same list, people that you know are deceivers. Joseph Biden, Hillary Clinton, whoever you want to name, it's healthy to be making the record of people that you believe are unhealthy, opportunistic people, and then on the other hand, the people that you believe are good and trustworthy. So I hope I've made that point adequately. I think it's important to reemphasize these during every call because this is the nuts and bolts of how we build our self-governing communities. And I go over it basically in each conference. Different people come in, they hear at a different time, and there's opportunities to ask me for questions and stuff so that people that think I'm absolutely stark raving crazy, you can challenge me on it. And maybe there's somebody here right now that would like to do that. Any questions or comments? I yield. Anybody? Hearing no questions or comments or challenge, let's cruise on. Ah, 4C. New cases to be placed before our Supreme Court of Law. Is there anybody that might have a case that they would like to bring before our Supreme Court of Law? Anybody? In this section, I have mentioned a case that I'm becoming entangled in. It's a foreclosure case with Cynthia Moore in South Carolina. There's a number of things that are going on in undercurrents there, and it's in the mix, and we just discovered there's an order already in place where so-called master inequity judicial officer has presumed to empower the banker's attorneys to move for a writ that can forcibly eject Cynthia from her home with very little process, probably not even any hearing. So anyway, there's a lot going on there in the foreclosure realms, and I'm sure similar problems are affecting our friends in Canada and all across the globe. And in terms of common law, every single one of those foreclosures, they do not have lawful authority to evict you based upon simply a default in failure to pay mortgages. Even in modern American case law, that's against the law to evict a person. A mortgage foreclosure judgment, trustee sale, or foreclosure sale, that all of that is just a lien on the property. The issue of rights of possession is an entirely different form of process, and that requires a prior peaceable possession by the bankers or their attorneys or something like that, and they never have that. So if we can ever get our proper common law courts up and running, all of the foreclosures in America will be immediately stopped, and the standard of living of our American people will immediately multiply two or threefold because you won't be paying any more mortgage debt on your house. And there's similar process for people that are only renting. There's ways of addressing that issue too, so the housing issues can be used very quickly and efficiently. Once we convert to a common law model of government, the housing issues will immediately allow people to have their own homes free and clear without any debts or absentee landlords threatening to kick them out of their home. And this will promote peace and happiness for our common people. So, any questions or comments on this section of our agenda? Anybody? I yield.
I'm sort of like that, too.
I can barely hear somebody in the background there. Is there somebody trying to get the microphone here? Maybe not. And item 4D, would anybody like to step forward and place any new items on our agenda for next week's conference. Anybody? Nothing? Let's go on to item number 5, which we're revisiting again. We, in our last week's conference, we got a 6th juror to agree to sign on to our jury verdict that we're under. We're declaring that there is not adequate evidence to presume that there's a medical emergency through this coronavirus thing. We've highlighted the point in our documents here that the so-called coronavirus has not been isolated in any laboratory proceedings. It's all conjecture by morally compromised scientists that are in the service of the pharmaceutical industries. They have not isolated the virus, and there's multiple reasons why this entire coronavirus thing is a fraud at the get-go. And a lot of us like the results, the symptom of this underlying problem is people wearing masks all over the place, and people are insisting on other people wearing masks, and some of us are getting angry about that. But I dare suggest, and the isolation and the quarantining and the shutting down the businesses and things like that, all of those are symptoms. Those are resulting problems from the underlying lie that the coronavirus has been legitimately identified in the first place, and thereunder that it is actually causing health detriment illnesses in people. These things have not been scientifically proven, and our complaint here that Abraham Duran has agreed to bring before the court, and Jim Bleakley and four others and myself have all agreed basically to sign on, subject to final review, that this entire coronavirus thing is a fraud. And people inclined to argue about the masks, please put that on the back burner. The argument that's better to make is that no coronavirus has even been proven to exist as to cause diseases here anyway. We know coronaviruses exist. They were with us way before this emergency was declared. Coronaviruses are really quite common, but they have not identified a specific coronavirus 19 like they're talking about, or shown anything like that to be the cause of illnesses. So that's the issue to be talking about as the main issue, and then thereunder you can talk about how the masks cause additional disease through rehaling your carbon dioxide and causing germ environments on your mask and stuff that you're breathing back in and out. I'd like to open the floor to discussion about the merits of this counter-complaint that we're bringing forward here on the coronavirus militarism response. And I'd like to also at the same time ask if there's maybe a 7th person here in our group that is comfortable enough and outraged enough about what all of everything's going on here that maybe you also would help us get towards our ultimate goal of 12 signatures, 12 people willing to sign on to this jury verdict, whereafter we can really start confronting the evil militarism agenda that's coming at us here. So, with that being said, is there any comments or questions or volunteers to serve as a juror here? I yield. Anybody? Well, fun. I'm doing all the talking. Yeah, that's okay. I can, I want to chatter a little bit more about this. This is a really big thing, because we're also, in the basic complaint here, we're also naming multiple government officials and associated agencies. We're naming the Federal Reserve Bank and individual 12 bankers, the 12 Federal Reserve District banks. So we're reaching into economic issues through this coronavirus complaint. It's really a profound complaint that can cause a major upset in the way government is being run. This is a really, really powerful process here, and I'm just really enthused about its potential. And I think if people were to and people thinking about signing on here, please realize that the powers that be after this election here, no matter who gets in, they as president, they could start moving with this and start dragging people off to FEMA camps or start doing forcible vaccinations real quick. So please consider carefully and prayerfully about placing your signature on the jury verdict here, because we can't move forward with this until we've got 12 signatures. And so I should again yield. Comments or questions, anybody?
Charles, I just wanted to speak to the merit of what you're saying there. We have some patriots in Canada on the West Coast in our Vancouver province, very, very similar to California in a lot of ways. We have some patriots in the middle of sitting their own common law grand jury. They're doing something similar. They're approaching it a little differently from what I'm hearing from you guys here, but certainly the same type of substance. As you know, we're doing this each individual province. We don't have the population to do anything smaller, but our provinces are already neatly divided and have already been granted their legal authority to do this. So that's why we're not trying to group anything up as you guys have. It would make sense for us to do that, but we've already got lawful and legal borders to use. So that's how we're doing it. But I just wanted to speak to that because they're doing something very similar to what you're saying here now. And we're kind of hoping that they can have some success and get some of our other provinces to kind of go along with that as well, or at least give it a shot.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm really glad for what you're saying there, Shane. It's important to do something in good faith. And to make the record, and it's a dividing process between sheep and goats, and even if you've got technicalities in your wording wrong, if the basic spiritual side of the battle will be separating the bad guys from the good guys, generally, anyway. And you might get 1 to 5% of your population shifting around, but generally speaking, you'll have already laid the foundation and done the homework by doing things similar to this, and so you'll be farther. You will have progressed further by starting doing exactly what you're talking about there, Shane. And that's good, and I salute you guys for doing that. As time goes on, I'm sure we'll have opportunities to coordinate, and maybe you guys will be showing me things that we're doing wrong here, and I hope that you guys will be open to constructive criticism from us about how to improve what you're doing, because it's all a spiritual battle, and we've got the same Israelite Torah law and Anglo-American common law tradition that we're trying to get back to the roots of, if I'm not misstating the case there. And they're under, you know, we constructive criticism, people working together, steel sharpens steel. These are important concepts to have clearly in our mind as we're building organic self-governing communities here. So,
certainly.
Yeah, thank you, Shane. Yeah, comments or questions from anybody else on how the discussion's going here? Okay. Well, move on. We're going to get a good groundswell discussion going here soon. I'm sure I can feel it. Agenda item 6. The constructive notice of treason. Yes. Brother Lewis, can you pull up that second web link there, the one with the citations document? There we go. Can you blow that one up? This is something that I did read last time, and I'm kind of thinking about reading again this time, because I didn't give Lewis opportunity to have this document on the screen last time when I read it, and I think it will be more clear to people as we're proceeding here when we have the words on the screen and people can see that we've got a United States Senate report number 93.549 talking about emergency war powers statutes. This United States Senate report was produced in 1973. Okay, and as the text clearly indicates there, and the web links, there's web links underneath it too for where you can see the original text and the original document. This isn't just Charles Stewart typing stuff out of his imagination here. But I'd like to go through it again because this is the battle line between the entire system of the evil empire, the slave traders of the Roman Empire. They're using fraudulent declarations of emergency, as this U.S. Senate report clearly indicates. They're fabricating out of thin air declarations of emergency, where under they gain color of legitimacy, where they can pretend like they're serving some legitimate public interest when they're actually serving their own private slave trading community interest. Okay? These liars are using these declarations of emergency to advance an agenda of totalitarianism and slave trading. And it's fundamental to both our remedy and the problem. And if I might go ahead and read here, quoting, "A majority of the people of the United States have lived all of their lives under emergency rule, period. For 40 years, that was in 73, so what would that be 40 years prior to 70? That would be 33. That would be about when Franklin Delano Roosevelt was taken, was doing stuff with the Federal Reserve Act. And what happened in 33? I don't know. Anybody know there? What happened in 33?
Oh, without question.
What was it, Lewis?
33, that's the New Deal comes into play. The currency actually is replaced on, March of 33? Actually went into effect in June, but remember, that was the banking holiday and the shutdown and the switch of the currency.
Yeah.
All of that happened in 1933.
Yeah, they contracted the money supply and foreclosed on all kinds of farms and everything, right?
Exactly, and they actually switched the species of currency that we were using, that the people were using at the time, going from, you know, the currency backed by value to the Federal Reserve note. That was done during the banking holiday of 1933.
Yeah.
So this financial system came into place at that time.
So that's exactly what is being referred to here by the reference to 40 years in this U.S. Senate report document, isn't it?
Yes. I believe so, 100%.
Yeah.
And Charles, what Lewis just said cannot be overstated. The importance of people knowing what occurred on the exact date he was just saying and exactly how it happened, and now the result of, that is something that should be like required knowledge. Daily, you should have to get up and read that out loud to yourself.
Yeah. Thank you, Shane. And that's part of why I don't feel that it's counterproductive in any way to go through the same basic script as we're bringing the conference into life, and it frequently gets quite energized with people going back and forth and competing for the microphone. But as we're starting out here, frequently it is kind of slow. And the issues that we're discussing are bedrock. They're so fundamental that each week we need to go over them. Every time we do our conference, it's good to go through them. And we can just kind of fast track some of them that are not of current interest. But when we get to specific issues like this, it's good to take some time and refamiliarize everybody with exactly what's going on. If there's no comments or questions further, I would like to continue reading on. Any comments or questions, or can I continue here?
Charles, just that I think if Lewis was up for it, because his voice is aesthetically pleasing as well, I think a little recording of him giving a quick synopsis of that could be something that you could share out to members, or members could share to other people in their lives, and that might be just another way to get that information out, because it is of vital importance for people to understand that.
Thank you for that suggestion, Shane, and I can't help but think that Lewis's quality of voice. Lewis, would you be available? Could I draft you to maybe do a reading of this U.S. Senate report, the couple paragraphs there? Would you be up to that, Brother Lewis?
Okay, let's I'll give you a couple of paragraphs here.
I didn't mean to put you on the spot. I just your cadence and the way you explain things, it just comes off really nice. I think people would be more appreciative of that as opposed to other ways or other mediums.
Well, I'm just keeping myself muted. My wife goes through her cleaning ritual and she plays music while she's doing it, so that's why I've got some background noise here. So as long as that does not interfere. I don't have a problem adding a couple of paragraphs here, Charles. So let
Thank
me know
you, Lewis.
If it's too loud.
Please go ahead.
Sure. So we were at it for 40 years.
Yeah.
Freedoms and governmental procedures guaranteed by the Constitution in various degrees been abridged by laws brought into force by states of national emergency. The problem of how a constitutional democracy reacts to great crisis, however, far antedates the Great Depression. As a philosophical issue, its origins reach back to the Greek city-states and the Roman Republic. And in the United States, actions taken by the government in times of great crisis have, from at least the Civil War, in important ways shaped the present phenomenon of a Permanent State of National Emergency. American political theory of emergency government was derived from John Locke, the English political philosopher, whose thought influenced the authors of the Constitution. Locke argued that the threat of national crisis, unforeseen, sudden, and potentially catastrophic, required the creation of broad executive emergency powers to be exercised by the chief executive in situations where the legislative authority had not provided a means or procedure, a remedy. Referring to emergency power in the 14th chapter of his second treatise on civil government as prerogative, Locke suggested that it, quote, should be left to the discretion of him that has the executive power, since in some governments the lawmaking power is not always in being and is usually too numerous and too slow for the dispatch requisite to executions. And because also it is impossible to foresee, and so bylaws to provide for all accidents and necessities that may concern the public, or make such laws as will do no harm if they are executed with an inflexible rigor on all occasions and upon all persons that may come in their way. Therefore, there is latitude left to the executive power to do many things of choice which the laws do not prescribe, end quote. I yield.
Thank you, Lewis. Thank you for that great summary. Give my vocal cords a break there. I appreciate it. I would like to emphasize, draw out main points here, because this document is of immense value in a number of areas. It not only clearly points out the lawless nature of our present system of government, it also shows the nature of where legitimate remedy is and how we should be focusing on trying to provide some form of remedy to these rampant declarations of emergency that are perverting our basic laws, because in the second paragraph there, about the sixth or seventh line above the end of the paragraph, is reference to the lawmaking power is not always in being and is usually too numerous and too slow for the dispatch of requisite executions. Okay, that's really the nut, the essence of the problem that the present model of government is facing. We've got 435 U.S. Senate or United States representatives, and then another 100 U.S. senators, and the bicameral system of government where the House makes it one decision-making process, and then the Senate makes another decision-making process, and then they come together to try to merge them. This is certifiably bipolar, split personality type of way of doing things. In contrast therewith, the deductions that are reasonably inferred from the common law tradition and the Israelite Torah law traditions indicate that the supreme governing body should consist of 12 members, and therefrom is drawn the chief executive officer in terms that are comfortable with this Senate report and the writings of John Locke. The writings of John Locke are basically meritorious in a lot of ways in the manner that he describes it, but it's painfully absent from his writings and his discussion here. is any reference to the common law tradition as it existed prior to the Norman conquest of England in 1066 AD. And I have trouble believing that Mr. Locke was ignorant of that. So I think Mr. Locke is similar to what I described in previous conferences. Mr. Blackstone also referenced beautifully that the ancient pure common law was based upon the Torah laws of Israel through Exodus 18. Mr. Blackstone directly quoted Exodus 18 with this hierarchy of tens and fifties and hundreds and thousands, which are the basis of true common law communities of townships, precincts, and counties. But see, we've got people like Mr. Blackstone and Mr. Locke giving us part of the truth, and that's very valuable that we're getting it. Like this U.S. Senate report, it's very valuable what we can get from these people, but they're not really giving us the whole truth. Thank you for highlighting that so efficiently, Lewis. They're not giving us the whole truth. They're not explaining to us how in ancient times there was manners, there was forms of government that were not too numerous or too slow for the dispatch of requisite executions. Okay? Moses didn't have these problems. I don't think Jesus Christ had these problems. I don't think King Arthur had these problems. But only modern American civilian governmental authorities have these problems. And I'm sure Canadian government and British government and all governments all across the planet have these kind of problems of being too numerous and too slow. And it's because the agents of evil know what the good model of government is, and they're purposefully trying to take us away from the common law model, the biblical Torah law model, because they know that it's a spiritual war, and if we start harmonizing with the correct spiritual model of government, then their days are going to be numbered and they're going to come to a close, because the people will start figuring out how to responsibly self-govern for themselves. So, I think that's an adequate digesting of the U.S. Senate report there. We should pause there for comments or questions. Anybody have any comments or questions on what we've covered here so far? Hearing none. Okay. That's a really important one there. But let us proceed on to discuss Agenda Item 7, which is of particular relevance on this day because this discusses the Electoral College. And I've emphasized before that the Electoral College, that word elector, that's a common law term. The assembly of the electors, I do believe the assembly of the electors that is, technically, the manner in which the U.S. Constitution has articulated that the President of the United States of America should be elected is dependent upon electors. Okay, and that's to the credit. That's to the credit. That's a good thing. That moves us in a direction of common law. But the manner in which they're organizing them, the manner in which the electors are constrained by the mandates in the document called the U.S. Constitution document that established a civil municipal government for our American people, it has outlined some parameters that are out of harmony with common law due process. specifically the bicameral, split personality, bipolar method of government with a separate House of Representatives and a separate Senate. That specific model, they're taking the original mandate from the original Constitution document was composed and applied today, we are ending up with, I believe, 535, or with Puerto Rico and Washington, D.C., and a few other oddball ones. I think we're up at 538 electors that are the larger body of electors that are currently presumed to interpreted to be qualified to decide who will be the President of the United States of America. But and we could work with that. That would be a decision if the model of government that we're talking about here, if this model of government were to move forward, we would probably eliminate the Senate, because the House of Representatives is, and we would eliminate the 100 electors that are necessary through the Senate to, as the Constitution mandates, and we would divide those 435 U.S. representatives by 12, and then by 12, and which would give us 432. 12 times 12 is 144, and then times 3 is 432, and that would put us right under the number of U.S. representatives that we would need, and we could gerrymander a little bit, but we would basically be preserving the U.S. House of Representatives with a minor tweak for the few other Senate representatives there. And so, to put it into modern context, please take a step back and realize that as these ideas, these points are being applied in our modern society, we're looking at scenarios of exactly right now what's going on between Mr. Trump and Mr. Biden. There is a similar situation that I think happened in the year 2000, where there was an election contested between George Bush and Albert Gore, and the U.S. Supreme Court stepped in and made a final decision in favor of George Bush in that case, and that is so dysfunctional with any theory of rule of law or accountability to the people. There's that is not an organic process. I am apprehensive that there may be another situation looming in the contest between Mr. Biden and Mr. Trump, where it will go to the Supreme Municipal Court of the United States of America. I think chances are over 50% on that now. And they're under. We need to be in position. Let me rephrase that. I want to do everything in my power to build a community of people that will be in position to take advantage of opportunities that may arise as the office of the president starts breaking down. If and when it breaks down, Michael Zarzano here from Florida, he's been, with some credibility, I dare suggest, predicting that he thinks it's likely that Nancy Pelosi for at least a short period of time, will end up being the occupant of the White House, the chief executive of the whole country here. Michael, I see you're in conference here. Would you like to chime in a little bit and maybe explain why you've been referencing that as a serious possibility here?
Well, it's on Tuesday night, I was on a show in Sarasota, Florida, and they asked me what I thought was going to happen in the election, and I immediately said that I felt that Pelosi would be the next president, interim, and that there's going to be a lot of trouble, and that's apparently what's happening so far. I don't think we're going to see Biden put into office before January, and if that happens, then Pelosi is most likely to be president.
Your wording there, I think, could use some tweaking. I think you said if Biden is put into office, then Pelosi will be president. Can you?
No, if he's not. If he's not.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah, it's only the media that's proclaiming him the victor, and you know there are multiple lawsuits, and there's also word it's being rumored that. There's actually a sort of a sting operation underway with these ballots. And it's come from a couple of reliable sources high up. One is a high military source that says that they have very clear evidence of mass fraudulent voting ballots. So time will tell. We'll see.
Yeah. Thank you, Michael. Yeah, it's very early to try to make predictions as to how things will go here, but...
Yeah, I just don't think that we're going to see a transition of the office before the required time in January, so...
Yeah. Well... I guess we'll find out soon enough. It could break a number of different ways. Mr. Trump might refuse to vacate, and even though Ms. Pelosi might be technically the optimal choice, Mr. Trump could resist both Ms. Pelosi and Mr. Biden. I don't know. I guess we shouldn't dwell too much on the current goofy situation that's been purposefully engineered to be goofy. But I did want to highlight that we're in a position, if we had, you know, $1 million dumped on us and we could start a marketing campaign and we had lots of people involved, and we could pay, you know, technical computer support and things like that, I think we would be in a position to affect this presidential election right now. And that might still happen if we just do our homework and are at least thinking in these kind of terms as things unfold, because the current system is deteriorating, and we definitely need options: Plan B, Plan C, Plan D, Plan E, so that we can land on our feet. If crazy stuff starts happening, rather when crazy stuff starts happening, because this system is unmaintainable, and we need to have options available for when things go schizo here on us here. Is there any other comments or questions here on this issues about the Electoral College here before we move on to our agenda items? Anybody? Hearing none. Welcome, Cynthia. Our agenda item 8 is economic issues, including a discussion of alternative currency and banking systems, and also issues related to how to engineer economic support for our local, responsibly self-governing communities. This issue is especially focused on economically sustaining our primary grassroots level qualified electors, as they are so economically sustained through each and all of us, all of their individual 10 household townships and tithing groups. We hereunder also expect to discuss cutting-edge grassroots empowerment, which is available through responsible and strategic use of the Uniform Commercial Code, and this along with explanations of how securing holder in due course status legitimately and significantly empowers modern activists to discharge debts of any and every sort and which they might be presumed to be owing to other people, corporations, and or governments. And we've got a document composed incompletely. It's still rough around the edges, but it is web link there, and it discusses a number of important options there. And again, Michael Zarzano has been influencing our discussions by proposing that we should be targeting a criminal complaint against the Federal Reserve banking monopoly, similar to what we're doing with our coronavirus jury verdict. Such a proposition inherently requires discussion of the alternative economic systems, which are generally being considered in this larger category. And this can be done in manners which minimize and reduce the potential for violence or war, as we're trying to engineer a smooth transition to an alternative form of government without disrespecting or being cold towards any of our honorable people's legitimate economic needs for enough food, clothing, and shelter to survive, to maintain self-sufficiency. There should be a minimal standard of living for everybody that is doing the basic steps necessary to become registered as a qualified elector, and also their entire household. Even if there's just one qualified elector in a household, the entire household would be covered. I can jump into details about these economic issues, but we've already mentioned a few points there. Anybody have any comments or questions on these economic issues? Hearing none. Let me point out that some of the details in the PDF document that is web linked there, I'd like to point out that the present local police departments and sheriff's departments that are operating similarly as municipal franchisee police departments, those police departments have people that are on a regular municipal payroll that are administering force within our local communities, and they're routinely administering force in unlawful manners. When we have alternative economic systems based upon the Uniform Commercial Code that gets us away from the Federal Reserve banking system, then we can give a raise in the standard of living to all police officers and sheriff's deputies that are willing to convert to common law jurisdiction peace officers, we can raise their standard of living by 10%. And this should incentivize them to quit enforcing municipal slave trading codes and rather to partake with us in enforcing the peace, keeping the peace, prohibiting breaches of the peace. If there's no breach of the peace officer needs to just kick back and put his boots up on as he sits on his front porch, thinking everything's good. Everything's good here. We got peace. My duties are completed. And he don't have to take his feet down off of the bar on his front porch until somebody breaches the peace. And if nobody breaches the peace, then he can have his whole day just not doing nothing because everybody's happy. It's a good thing. And minimal standards of living. See, a lot of this goes to a lot of what's currently going on, what's labeled as riots. And I kind of think I might be getting close to Lewis's heart here, and that a lot of the anger that is percolating up through, like, the Black Lives Matter movement and the Antifa movement, a lot of it is justified because people are economically disenfranchised. They're angry about being treated like slaves, scrapping, working as hard as they do all the time for just breadcrumbs, while the wealthy are living in grandiose lifestyles. That's evil, and it needs to change. And the alternative economic systems that we're talking about here can quickly and efficiently be promoted amongst Black Lives Matter communities and Antifa communities, because these alternative economic systems will dismantle the economic empires of people like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett. Their empires have been gained through unlawful enrichment process. They're obscenely wealthy, and that wealth needs to be distributed down amongst the common people. They can still live very, very high if they comply without a whole lot of opposition to this kind of an agenda. But if they entrench and they participate in criminal racketeering conspiracies like Bill Gates is already guilty of, then all of their estate's going to be taken. And Mr. Gates will be lucky if he doesn't go to jail. And the same with a lot of the other billionaires and stuff. So when we comprehend the Queen of England, the Vatican, that they have so much wealth. There is so much wealth on this planet that can be made available to raise the standard of living of people that are just living hand to mouth, scraping the dirt with their fingernails just to get enough to survive. The level of poverty of the vast majority of people on this earth is obscene. It's terrible. It's a sin against God. And it needs to be righted and corrected. And these alternative economic systems, if we get behind them, I am quite convinced that they can provide very beautiful remedy, economic empowerment, economic security for all of our people. And I'm optimistic that someday soon, if we keep plugging away at these conferences, we're going to secure this type of economic security for our common people. And it'll be a utopian type situation. Everything can be so beautiful in a system, in a governmental structure that has an honorable economic and accounting system. So, comments or questions there? Anybody? Comments or questions about economic policies? Hearing none, I guess we'll go on to agenda item number 9. Any affirmations or denials of qualified elector status of anybody? We're revisiting that issue. Anybody? I'm willing to affirm that everybody here is a qualified elector. I think I know y'all well enough. Roland's kind of new there from Polk County, Florida, but I'm inclined to believe he's a qualified elector, and if I see something that he's doing that's wrong later on down the line, him or anybody, I'll revoke it. I'll take it back. I'll quit certifying them as qualified electors. This is how organic government works. Is it's a moment-by-moment thing. And if at any moment somebody goes schizo and starts acting like a criminal, well, the rest of us need to recognize it at that moment and thereby decertify the person as a qualified elector. You can't just all of a sudden change your mind and start acting like a criminal and still expect to retain your qualified elector status. It's a continuing organic process where you need to maintain your qualified elector status at all times, or else you're going to be called to account for it by the other qualified electors in the community. Comments, questions on that? Anybody? Hearing none. Agenda item 10. Our friends in Canada. Shane, you stepped away from the screen there. Are you available to maybe give us an update on?
No, Shane indicated through chat a little while ago that he's got to get his little one to bed, and
okay.
Signed off with his contact information in the chat box.
Okay. Well, thank you, Shane, and thank you, Lewis, for bringing me up to speed on that. I wasn't watching the chat box real well. Agenda item 11, what have I got there? That's the racial violence issue. We've got a pretty tame audience here, Lewis. You don't feel like touching on that at all, do you?
Follow okay. Following your lead, Charles. Go ahead there. I see this mic is not on. This is agenda item 11. I thought that this was always an ambitious agenda, getting down to double digits. So you've been able to do it today. I'm thoroughly impressed. I yield the floor.
Thank you. Well, it wouldn't have happened if we had our normal level of discussion, but our audience here is just a smidgen thin. I would like to point out, not directly related to this, but Abraham sent me a web link, and I think I may have mentioned it in the last conference, there's people in Minneapolis that in Minneapolis, they're actually making progress towards dismantling their police department, and which is a good thing. I am glad, and I'm inclined to believe that you share my enthusiasm over that also, Lewis. Am I correct there?
Oh, certainly.
Yeah.
I think that, and defunding is just redirecting the funding to other sources that are more productive.
Yeah. And I don't know if you saw the article, but I referenced it in the last conference, I believe, that there are people already volunteering to go around at nights. And apparently some of the people that are loosely associated with Antifa and or BLM are actually engaging in violence, it seems like. But others are responding to volunteer to function as common law jurisdictions, so to speak, and they're kind of self-policing, self-governing there to make sure that the violence is kept to a minimum. Have you heard of that, Lewis? And if so, what's your general opinion of how all that's developing there?
I did hear that when you referenced it. I think I'd listened to the, I think that was call before last, after I hopped off of the call, and you referenced that, and I took a look at that, and I'm in complete agreement there. You know, there's been other cities that have done that, that have defunded the police, and in fact sent other entities out, especially for mental health calls, which there have been a few recent, I should say through the year, probably when you take a look at it, about half of these calls that have ended in police violence, several were mental health checks that were called. So they stopped doing that, I mean, like 17 years ago, and have had positive results. So finally, some of these other municipalities are looking at to some, you know, other areas that have done this some time ago. So it's not a new, you know, it's not a new phenomenon. It is something that they've been aware of and simply chosen not to go that direction, chosen to go the militarization route. So, you know, I would hope that others take a look at that, just as Minneapolis, or I believe that's Minneapolis, Minnesota, that was doing so. I yield.
Yeah, thank you, Noah.
Oh, I also agree with you on one other time. I didn't unmute quick enough, but when you were discussing the vice mayoral setup of the government and how bipolar or schizophrenic, in fact, it is, and it is just that. So the Senate, which represents the states, not the people, you know, to say that it's we the people and the power, the people have the power, and then to install a bring it to existence an entity that is above the House of the People. It's actually the senior house, or the upper chamber, as they like to refer to it, is nonsensical. So
yeah.
You've immediately created an entity and installed it above the House of the People, which direct representation of the people. Yeah, it makes absolutely no sense. So I yield.
Thank you, Lewis. Thank you for affirming that. When people contemplate the insanity of the present model of government, I just want to pull my hair out when people start talking about how divinely inspired the Constitution is, and how George Washington was such a godly man, and Alexander Hamilton and the other founders. I just want to pull my hair out, because that system was engineered to treat the average working class American as a slave. That's how it was engineered. It was just what they did. The English government under which we were previously existing was adulterated with the Roman Empire municipal model of government. That's why it became tyrannical and oppressive. And the King of England and Queen, they became more like a Roman emperor, a god king, than a king under the rule of law, under the rule of the common law. There was, in the olden times, there was mechanisms of accountability over the king, and but ever since the Norman Conquest, there's no mechanism of accountability, and it's just another version of the Roman Empire model of government. And so, with the grand opportunity of an American revolution to throw off the chains of tyranny and create a new system of government, they actually gave it a half-hearted. They did pretty good with the Articles of Confederation. That was a single unicameral system of government, no separation of powers. See, that's two different points. Unicameral is single governing body, single legislative power with no separate Senate and House. There's not two different houses. There's one House, one general constitutional congressional assembly, and they're under at the same time. It's not there under. It's to the side, a different issue. The so-called different departments of judiciary and different departments of executive as opposed to the legislative. No. Throw that all out the window. Under Articles of Confederation, the judicial was part of the legislative assembly, and so was the executive part of the legislative assembly. And if you remember U.S. Senate report here, where it says that the whole reason that we got to have a tyrannical system of Roman Empire model of government is because the assembly is too slow and too numerous for being able to move quickly and efficiently to address the needs. Well, guess what? The Articles of Confederation General Congressional Assembly was quite able to move quickly and efficiently, at least in comparison with the system we got now. You know, the system we got now is way, way painfully slow and dysfunctional. The Articles of Confederation, they had a single governing body, and it had executive, legislative, and judicial authority all in that single governing body. And that is real similar. The similar ancient pre-Norman conquest system, which is really our foundational bedrock that we need to be getting back to, was called the Assembly of the Wise Men. The exact Anglo-Saxon terminology was the Witangamot. Gamot, it means assembly, and Witan means wise men, assembly. And it's in your Black's Law Dictionary, and you can look it up on Wikipedia and things like that, too. But that is very similar to the Articles of Confederation. And if we'd have stuck with that, we would be in excellent shape right now. But Alexander Hamilton, the money changer, and George Washington, the murderer, they had other agendas. They had slave trading agendas. They were all aristocrats that were addicted to the Roman Empire model of government that was happening in England. They just wanted to out the king. They wanted their own Roman Empire model of government where they were in control. That's what the scheme was. They were high-level Masons, okay? They were having their secret little meetings. For God's sake, it's well documented. The Boston Tea Party, that was engineered by Masons. It was all Masons that partook in that. So we've got entrenched evil, and it's part of the design of our present system of government. And unless we revert back to the more pure principles that were of responsible self-governing, that were actually meaningful, accountable, organic accountability of the higher levels of government to the lower levels of government. These are so important for the welfare of the people. And the previous models have existed well at various times in our history. And if we just are diligent about refocusing on the tried and true proven ancient models of organizing self-governing communities in a organically accountable hierarchy, then we can save this entire system from the agents of evil that are oppressing us and treating us like slaves. So, comments, questions there? Anybody? We're doing quite a little bit of ranting here. I'm doing more than my fair share of the discussion here. I do appreciate people that are participating, like Lewis and Shane there. And I even appreciate the people that are just here listening. I appreciate everybody. Positive vibes for everybody. But last item on the agenda. Are we actually going to get to I think we're going to get to the last item. We are getting close to our cutoff time. Oh, we're getting right close to our cutoff time, Lewis. We might actually end right with a formal business meeting completed and no after discussion. Anyway, agenda item 12. Is there any new cases or agenda items that anyone would like to bring before our court so that we can put it on the agenda for our next Saturday conference? Anybody? Anybody? Yoo-hoo. Not hearing anything. I'm thinking maybe we should take a moment here to just go straight to open floor discussion. We've got about 5 minutes left before we might be considering seriously putting a wrap on everything here. Does anybody have anything that they would like to talk about at all? Anybody? The election? Foreclosure cases? QAnon?
I've got a suggestion perhaps for next week's agenda, just on an open floor section. How there may be some others on this call that are involved in some of those efforts, which with groups of people that are attempting to re-inhabit and reform the Republic. Specifically, you mentioned the Articles of Confederation. There is a group that is, in fact, has undertaken that effort, and you know that I spent some time with. So I see our Supreme Court of Law fitting in with that effort, I guess, differently than others. So perhaps a conversation on how you see the Supreme Court, I mean, the people on the call that take, you know, some time to come and participate on the call, how you see the Supreme Court of Law fitting in with any other efforts to repopulate, re-inhabit, and reform the Republic. Because I do have a vision, which mine and may differ from Charles's vision, but I think it fits and is not in conflict. And that perhaps would be something that I'd like to discuss on next week's call, because I think there may be some other people, on, as I mentioned, on this call that are involved in other efforts. And do they see this fitting in, what we're doing, and the Supreme Court of Law, period, or do they see it in being in conflict? So I yield. That was a suggestion for next week's agenda.
All right. I will put that on next week's agenda. And that opens up the related issue of trying to coordinate with other groups so that we can all come together harmoniously and take the country back from the agents of evil here. I'll definitely plan on putting that on the agenda. We could jump into that for a discussion right now, but I imagine you're following your two-hour schedule there, and for yourself anyway, it'd probably be better to just table it until next week. Is that correct, Lewis?
That is, Charles.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Well,
but I did want to put that out there for some others to give that some thought as well. I'd like to hear from some others on this call next week as well. So just kind of wanted to plant that seed.
Yeah. Good work, Lewis. I'm going to float a proposition that we conclude our meeting here. Right at our five-hour mark, we don't have a whole lot of, or our two-hour mark, I should say. We don't have a whole lot of people competing for the microphone here. Most of us have other projects that are worthy of our time and attention, so we don't want to just lollygag around here if we're not accomplishing anything. So one final call. Is there any comments or questions or propositions from anybody in attendance in the conference here before we try to put a wrap on it and conclude our conference here this meeting? Comments or questions from anybody? Final call here.
Yes, this is Roland.
Roland, hi.
What state are y'all in?
I'm in Texas. Lewis there is in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What are you thinking, Roland?
I just wanted to know, asking about electors, would it have to be for your state or what?
Well, we're very organic here, and that issue of which state is pretty much custom tailored for the individual elector. We can recognize electors in just the USA here, and we can worry about what state they're in or what county they're in or what precinct they're in later on down the line, depending on how much detail each of the individual electors decides to embrace. But we're willing to start certifying electors here on just a national basis, and anybody that seems like a reasonable person here will get my affirmation. I think that's a good process. Does that answer your question, Roland?
Yes. Yes, it did.
All right. Well, I'm glad to see you with us here. And I do hope you'll continue with us. Usually our conferences are much more energized than this. People start competing for the microphones and stuff. But tonight here was rather tame and not much competition, and which has its own advantages. It's a nice, peaceful discussion that way. But, yeah, I do hope you'll join with us in the future, Roland. And
Yes, I will. I do a lot of listening. You know, I come in occasionally, but I do a lot of listening. You know, the sad thing, my family's been involved with this since the 60s, and it was shown to me when I was 14 years old, and, you know, I was in school and still being brainwashed, and I just couldn't believe it. And now that I'm living it as an adult, I see it every day.
Yeah.
We're nothing but their ATM machine anymore now.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Like the battery in the Matrix, you know, we're just used to energize their system. They're feeding off of our energies.
If you study it out, it's highfalutin people or high up, a group of people has decided they're going to make their living off of us.
Yeah.
While claiming they're serving us.
Mm-hmm.
And the Bar Association, somehow we got to get rid of it. It's what the problem is.
Oh, yeah, they're at the center. That goes to the corruption of the judiciary. The entire judiciary is corrupted. That Bar Association wouldn't be a problem for us if it wasn't for the judicial officers that are choosing to recognize that Bar Association.
Well, they are the Bar. They're a member of it also.
Yeah, but they gained the power to do that Bar Association gobbledygook through their monopoly on the judicial power.
Yeah, I mean, truthfully, I think the Bar is running all the courts and just giving a state a cut of it.
Well, it gets so blurry there. You know, does the tail wag the dog or does the dog wag the tail? The Bar and the judicial officers, they're incestuous. They're working together in their own criminal
act. One can't get along without the other.
Yeah.
Okay, you got me hooked.
Vicky, there we go.
Okay, you want to know what happened. You know, in 17, that constitution, that con, was drafted in 1787. In 1785, the dictionary definition for states is nobility. And you can look it up in Webster's 1828 dictionary. It was still one definition for states, S-T-A-T-E-S, nobility. Are you aware of that?
Go ahead, Roman.
Okay, so the reason I'm saying that is we, the people of the United Nobility, in order to form a more perfect union for ourselves and our posterity, and if you look up the definition for Esquire in 1785 and, you know, going forward for many, many years, even into 1828 in Webster's, they are the younger sons of noblemen forever. So, yes, it's the members of the bar, of course, and, you know, they are the esquires, and they are the younger sons of noblemen, so it was written for them and their posterity.
Well,
so
that's the way they're interpreting those words.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's the way they're interpreting those words.
Right, by the dictionary definition, that's contemporaneous exposition is what is called in legal language.
Well, if I might, I think the word nobility is similar to aristocracy, and Thomas Jefferson made some good statements about natural aristocracy, and I think that is similar to what would be in common law terminology the inner circle of the judicial officers. It would be people that rise on merit rather than just heredity of from the reptilian bloodlines, or however you want to look at it.
Yeah, but you know, and the thing is, Charles, and I'm not, you know, I'm not adversarial to any of this. Just you bring forth the definitions at the time that they were, that the things were being done. And the Magna Carta was brought forward because of King John's concessions to Pope Innocent III, okay, and which turned over the entire British Commonwealth into a feudalistic form of serfdom to the Pope, okay, that Pope Innocent III, for him, his successors and assigns going forward. So with that in mind, keep in mind that the barons, it was the nobles, okay, there were barons who came forth and said, hey, we've had enough of this, and that established the common law. However, I like using the term natural law, because we are to assume amongst the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitle us. And we are at that course of human events, according to, you know, 1776, the Declaration of Independence. When in the course of human events, which we're at now, it becomes necessary for number one, okay, for one people to dissolve dissolve the political bands which connect them to another. And that's what we're dealing with now. It was the Whigs and the Tories back then in the 1700s, and prior to that, in Yeshua's day in the first century, it was the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And everyone has had to overturn the tables of the money changers. It was the Bank of England back in the 1700s, and today it is the Federal Reserve System, which with the 17th Amendment had essentially but breached Article 1, Section 3 of the U.S. Constitution, and then nullified the 10th Amendment, because the states and the people who had already directly elected their representatives to the Senate had no representation since 1913 because of the direct election of senators that were chosen and approved by the Federal Reserve. Good boys. Okay? Good boys. They are not good boys, but you know what I'm talking about. So anyway, you know, there's some historical evidence that has been thrown since the get-go, and I'd like to see actually that brought before a jury of our peers. Just, you know, all the fraud that has gone on since the beginning based on the contemporaneous exposition of the words at that time that it was written. And the people who have aided and abetted them ever since. legislators that, create the political bands that bind us to this court system that, hey, you know, constitutions mean nothing. And I can show you more, you know, as far as, the wording of that preamble in Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Virginia, it was we, comma, the people. And in just about in every state of the union, that the constitutions for the states all have the people, that political powers are in the people, and they have at all times an inalienable and indefeasible right to alter, reform, abolish, you know, however they have the wording in that particular constitution, but it's always the people. And in the preamble that is congressional preamble, in, you know, the congressional terms, is we the people, no commas. And it's in a bigger font. So the PICA was different. And the PICA meant something according to the claim of cognizance, that they hold PICA. They hold so if someone's private trust or private corporation is the way it's actually put forward in the documents. It's been fraud since the get-go, and so they have done nothing wrong legally. I mean, they're just following their constitution. But, you know, we, the people, we have been duped into a contract that was not fully disclosed from the get-go, for one thing, and our ancestors came to this country and they bargained their full faith and credit for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And under the assumption that, you know, that's what they would be getting, and of course we don't get that, especially under the 13th Amendment that, you know, allows for voluntary servitude, with which if you do not comply, you're going to be duly convicted of a crime, because anyone who is subject to that jurisdiction. And, of course, you know, they check the little box, you're a U.S. citizen, and I'm going off on a tangent, and I'm sorry, Charles, I do that every time. And I've been quiet, though, right?
Right, but I was trying to tell you there, you've got your speakerphone on or something, and your voice is very garbled. It's very difficult
yes,
to hear.
Yes, it's true, Charles.
Pardon me?
Yours is Charles. Yours has been all the way through, yes. It's been very garbled. Yeah, when you listen again, if you have this recorded somewhere and listen again, you'll see how bad the connection was.
Well,
and I'm sorry, I don't know who it was that was that. But anyway, where I was going with that is that in 1913, when the Federal Reserve System took over, and there was still silver in the coin, but in 1971, when they took all the silver out of the coin and they started to devalue it, actually since 1964, I believe it was, when all the silver was taken out of the coin, we have become their creditors. So we actually have a heck of a lot more power, knowing what we know about the contemporaneous exposition, as well as knowing that we are now their creditors. So, Charles, I'd like to see you and Lewis and Abe kind of work on putting something together to bring something like this before a jury in all 12 districts. And with that, I yield.
Okay.
I would like to comment on something what Nikki was saying, because actually doing my – this is Cynthia. Actually, with the foreclosure situation that Charles and I are working on for myself, I realized that the judge, he is disregarding every single thing. It's not the documents. It's not that what we're saying. He's not following the law. And I started looking like if we stop him – then none of these will go on, because when the judge feels like he's God, he can take control of everything, and that's why the situation is going on, because we're not stopping him when he's doing things improperly. So I decided I'm going to sue the judge, because we're allowing him to have these things to proceed when it should not. When he's taking away our constitution protection, our unalienable rights, he is doing this. Even though they're together, he's doing it. So we need to go after him to let him know that you're not going to do this. And I find out in the Constitution, Article 3, Section 2, that he is not a judge no longer when he's violating the Constitution. So I'm not going after him as a judge. I'm going after him as a citizen. Because he's not immune. He's a citizen when he disregards the Constitution. So I have the right to sue him. And if we start taking steps of suing the judge who's allowing this, then he will think, if people start doing that, because they're afraid, oh, the judge. And when the judge says something, no, he's not following the Constitution. He's supposed to be protecting us. So that's one thing. We do have a lot of rights, but we don't go after it because we're afraid.
Yeah, and the thing is that, you know, and we're back to that current, you know, what they said was going to be coming because of the political bans, because the thing is that this is taxation without representation is what you're talking about. Even with the judge, is taxation without representation.
Exactly.
Yes, but they put it subtly and, you know, sneakily into the origination of U.S. con, the United Nobility's con, based on the wording of that day. Yep. I hear you, Cynthia, loud and clear.
Yeah, that's why my argument is not going to be all over the board. It's going to be straight to the point. No jurisdiction. Put the laws in it. I'm not going to go, no, show me an injury. You cannot show me that, then I'll take it to another court. I'm going to sue your butt.
And the thing is, you were the creditor to begin with. It was based on your
Exactly.
Position.
And I'm changing it. I'm the plaintiff here. I own that property. You show me your interest in this property. You show me the injury. And you have no jurisdiction.
I hear you.
And I'm going to keep doing that. And when he violated, which he already did, I'm going to do a lawsuit on him. And I'm going to take it as far as I possibly can. And when people start doing this, because you just take a couple of people to start doing this, and actually this is the time it's going to really happen. Because of the coronavirus, people are not working. It's going to be a lot of foreclosures. And when these people see that they have rights, and when you put somebody in a situation when you know you have some rights and they're not even paying you no attention, and now you can't have a roof over your head or have a roof over your head for your family, we're going to start fighting back. And it just take a couple of people to start doing it. And it's going to be a big, major deal because people are losing their homes because of the coronavirus situation. And they're waiting for that because they're not giving you any relief to tell you, oh, you don't have to pay your payments for 4 months. And then when everything's okay, you got to come up with 4 months of payment? That's crazy from the beginning. If you can't pay 1 month payment, how are you going to pay 4 months? So this is the scheme here. Just like this whole election deal, we have to realize, you know, we got to pick one evil against the other evil. That's really crazy. No, we need to stop letting evil control us and say, no, you have no room in my home here. We shouldn't have been picking Biden or Trump because we have a problem with that because there's no Biden, there's no Trump. It's the 1% elite, the 13 family. There's no such thing as Democrat and Republican. It is a dominant and controlled system. And we realize that is one entity that you will call Lucifer. Say, I want to take over all of God's children. These people are just puppets, and they're making you think by you choosing someone and then separate us from black and white and Chinese and whatever. You're none of these things. Their body is not you. You're God's children that they're taking control of. It is a spiritual warfare. And once we sit here and divide our home, we will be conquered at all times. And I can't explain that no more than another. It's unity. Getting together and saying, no, you leave. And Iceland is a very good example. They put all the bankers in jail. And they then did it by me going to court and asking my enemy to save me. They say, no, what Charles was talking about, that we didn't ask if we're going to do it, but we can't do it by ourselves. We got to unite, and that's one major thing that we have to learn, to find some way that we can unite together and say we're tired of it. And I guess some people have to have a lot of fire behind their butt and get burned so bad, because actually I had to get burned somewhat as well for me to start fighting back, because I don't want this. I'm not going to tolerate it. And there's no fear in me about if I'm going to tolerate it or not, because you're not free. So hiding in the jail cell when the door is open is not helping none of us. So we need to figure out a way. No, I don't have all the answers, but I know, God, by listening to everything, nothing's going to happen until we stop this division and realize that we are God's children and we should not be treated, and we have the right to choose our own, make our own choice, as long as we're not harming another sentient being, and no one has the right to take that away. I yield.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Well said. Well said.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. We've got a lot on the table, and we're in a spiritual war zone, and we need to keep our lines of communication open with other good people, because it's a spiritual battle, and there will be moments where each of us become completely exhausted in fighting. And at that point, we need other good people around us that can take the ball and continue going while we catch our breath and get our legs back under us. So this is the importance of building our communities, so that somebody is always standing on the watchtower, watching for the aggressors coming against us, because they are relentless. But we probably ought to keep this conference short. We're down to just four of us here, and I'm really glad for the other three of you here. This is a good discussion, but I think we should put a wrap on it here, unless there's any other comments from any of the other three of you here. Anything any of the other three of you want to say as a concluding comment here?
No, Charles, but I do have to go. So anyway, thank you all. I really appreciate what you're doing, Charles. Okay, take care. Yahweh bless.
Good night, Nikki. All right, this is the 7th of November, 2020. I am Charles Stewart, and the business portion of our conference is definitely concluded. Oh, let's see, what time is it here? Yeah, about 20 minutes ago. We should have formally announced the conclusion there, but a little bit late there. And last call, Roland or Cynthia, any final comments?
No, I'm just going to say good night. It was nice. I'm sorry I was late.
We're okay, sister. I'm sure you were doing something important there.
Yeah.
But, yeah, same time, same channel next week. And with that, I guess we'll put a wrap on it and call it the end of this Supreme Court of Law conference for November 7th, 2020. And hit the recording button. We are concluding. Good night, everybody.